University of California Television presents this podcast of Sir Kitumile Masire, Conflict Resolution in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This program is the first of the 2005-2006 Securing Justice in the Pursuit of Peace Distinguished Lecture Series, sponsored by the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego, and was recorded October 27, 2005. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to the University of San Diego and the Joan Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice. We are delighted to see such a great turnout tonight and so many students with us. And I hope we've managed to empty out our overflow room. We had a number of people that we could not fit in the theater, but I hope we've managed to get everyone in this evening. My name is Joyce New, and I'm the Executive Director of the Institute for Peace and Justice. And I would like to acknowledge this evening our provost, Dr. Julie Sullivan, who is with us this evening. Dr. Sullivan is playing the key role in helping to create the new School of Peace Studies that will be getting underway, we hope, in the next year or so, which is a very exciting prospect for really expanding the work of peacemaking, the work of advancing knowledge in the field and academic excellence in this area. So it's quite an exciting complement to what the Institute has been doing and what the school will bring to the university. To introduce His Excellency Kitumile Masire, I will not go into all the details of his wonderful background because you have that in your program. But I would like to say that he grew up in the south of Botswana in an area known as the Kalahari Desert with four brothers and two sisters. And he told us yesterday that his name, Kitumile, in Setswana, which is the most widely spoken of 25 languages in Botswana, that Kitumile Masire means famous protector. As a teacher, journalist, political party leader, and head of state, His Excellency has, in fact, more than lived up to his name of protecting his people. Through good governance and sound economic policies, Botswana has remained an island of peace in a very hostile neighborhood. President of the Republic of Botswana from 1980 through 1998, he oversaw high economic growth rates, universal education, and in fact, this evening earlier, he was telling Dean Cordero that Dean Cordero asked him if, in fact, it was true that he personally gave out the diplomas to all the graduates of the University of Botswana. And he said, indeed, for 18 years, he had handed out the diplomas. I think there can be little doubt that in a country where the president gives out the diplomas, education is a high priority. His focus was on self-reliance and unity. And as he told us yesterday, when I asked him about the ethnic groups in Botswana, he said, they're welcome to practice their traditions, but in fact, we don't focus on ethnic groups. We focus on unity. People are, in fact, Botswanan first. This is a lesson that many other countries, from Bosnia to China to Rwanda, could stand to emulate. Some of you may be familiar with a wonderful series of novels about a Botswanan lady detective by Alexander McCall Smith. In the first book of the series, the lady detective's father reflects on his country, and he says, I am proud to be a Botswanan. There is no other country in Africa that can hold its head up as we can. We have no political prisoners and never have had any. We have democracy. We have been careful. The Bank of Botswana is full of money from our diamonds, and we owe nothing. Please join me in welcoming Sir Kitumile Masire, former president of Botswana, protector, mediator, and peacemaker.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to express my appreciation to the executive director of the Joan B. Krug Institute for Peace and Justice for inviting me to participate in this year's lecture series, Securing Justice in Pursuit of Peace. I'm also delighted to speak before an esteemed audience such as this one, comprising eminent personalities who have helped in shaping the direction of the international justice system in pursuit of international peace. In the context of the theme for this series of lectures, it is also my honor to bring to mind the Goldstone Commission, which laid the foundation for a new political dispensation in South Africa. For us in Botswana, we applauded the findings of the commission. We had suffered the brunt of the brutal attacks by the hostile apartheid regime, which deployed a series of commandos into neighboring territories during the South African liberation struggle. The Goldstone Commission was established to investigate the report and report on causes of political violence and intimidation which was plaguing South Africa. Some 20,000 people are reported to have died in the 10 years before the release of Nelson Mandela. The situation deteriorated even after his release. The findings of the commission are now in the public domain. There was an incontrovertible evidence of gross human rights violation in South Africa. Subsequent developments in South Africa include the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, headed by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, was set up for the purpose of promoting national unity and reconciliation. The mandate of the commission was to record and bear witness to reparations and rehabilitation. In some cases, it was to grant amnesty to perpetrators of crime relating to human rights violation. Due to the perceived success of this approach to dealing with human rights violation after excessive political change, other countries have instituted similar commissions. Sometimes I shudder when I recall some incidents of gross human violation that I have witnessed since I retired from public office in 1998. Soon after my retirement, the Organization of African Unity, now African Union, in an unprecedented move for that regional organization, set up a high-level investigative panel to examine the Rwanda genocide of 1994, in which about 800,000 people were massacred. I was the chairperson of the investigation team. Our mandate was to inquire into the underlying causes of the mass killings, look at the consequences throughout the Great Lake region, as assess the roles and responsibilities of the various local, regional, and international actors, including the United Nations and its agencies, and make recommendations about how to avert similar tragedies in the future. I believe that our report provided valuable lessons so that Africa will never again experience such a human tragedy while the international community looked on. I am happy that our panel contributed further to a body of valuable knowledge to help within the healing process, reconciliation, and the prevention of new violence after one group has inflicted great violence on the other, or where two groups have mutually harmed one another. After such a violence, how can groups that continue to live together build a better non-violence future? As the experts and the scholars of post-conflict reconstruction have observed, the impact of intense violence on survivors is enormous. Their basic psychological needs are profoundly frustrated. Their identity, their way of understanding the world, and their spirituality are disturbed. Their perception of the world and of the people as dangerous increases the likelihood that without a remedial action, former victims will become perpetrators. This likelihood had to be minimized in Rwanda. In this regard, I would like to commend the Rwandan authorities for their vision in establishing the necessary institutions to deal with such enormous challenges of healing, reconciliation, and nation building. In my country, Botswana, we believe in indigenous institutions for and approach to dispute resolution and reconciliation of parties. Such institutions have sustained our democracy. We believe in the traditional system of reconciliation and mutual acceptance by members of formerly hostile groups to each other. Such acceptance includes positive attitudes and correspondingly positive actions that express them. The society has entrenched structures that facilitate reconciliation and forgiveness. I am making this a reference to Botswana because of the similarity with the traditional approach of the Gacaca in Rwanda. Under the new government, Rwanda has built its physical and administrative infrastructures. But its most difficult task was to foster a reconciliation between the Hutu and the Tutsi. The Gachacha was a bold and successful experiment in national reconciliation and nation building. The Gachacha tribunals represent a remarkable democratization of justice for a people accustomed to dictatorial authority. The tribunals offer a voice and perhaps some therapy, a feeling of spiritual release and purification brought about by an intense emotional experience to survivors. However, the system is still fraught with pitfalls. For instance, modestly trained judges are assigned to complex cases. False accusations or confessions are inevitable. Revenge might affect testimonies, and inconsistent application of the law is a real risk. But how else would one then deal with such an accumulation of cases? Surely in such grave situations, we should live by the dictum, justice delayed is justice denied. As part of the restorative justice, the Rwanda authorities embarked on a program to release some prisoners from custody. According to reports of the Center for Justice and Reconciliation, because the country's prisons were filled to capacity, Rwanda government ordered the release of certain inmates. Some participants in the 1994 genocide who were not considered planners were among those released. Youth and those over 70 years old were also released. The government continues to help genocide offenders released from prison become reconciled. Restorative justice is a theory of justice that emphasizes repairing the harm caused or revealed by criminal behavior. It is best accomplished through the cooperative process that includes all stakeholders. Practice and programs reflecting restorative purposes respond to, among other things, identifying and taking steps to repair the harm. Two, involving all stakeholders. And three, restoring the traditional relationship between communities and their governments in responding to crime. Ladies and gentlemen, I have also been involved in the Democratic Republic of the Congo as the facilitator of the inter-Congolese dialogue. The Democratic Republic of Congo was at the center of what some have called Africa's First World War. The inter-Congolese dialogue created a peace and reconciliation commission with remit to institute principles that embrace the body of the rules that must guide national truth and reconciliation mechanism. The objective of the Peace and Reconciliation Commission were, inter alia, to achieve a reinstatement of the truth concerning political and socio-economic events in the Democratic Republic of Congo. B, reconciliation of political role players and reconciliation among the people themselves. C, helping the emergence and consolidation of the rule of law in the Democratic Republic of Congo. D, renaissance of a new national patriotic consciousness. And E, the reestablishment of a climate of mutual confidence between different communities and promotion of inter-ethnic reconciliation and collaboration. FF, reestablishment of national unity and cohesion. After painstaking negotiations, the Congolese parties to the Inter-Congolese Dialogue signed the final act in April 2003, which committed them to adhering to provisions of the resolutions that they had ratified at the same time. Alongside the Inter-Congolese negotiations, President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa played a mediation role. He was a constant voice for peace and compromise on the part of the Congolese parties. From the initial Inter-Congolese dialogue in Sun City into the talks in Pretoria that led to the signing of the Memorandum of Understanding on the withdrawal of Rwandan troops from the Democratic Republic of Congo. President Mbeki again hosted the Congolese factions in Pretoria to reach an agreement on the interim power-sharing government. Another notable personality in the DRC peace process was former president of Senegal, Moustapha Niass, as the special envoy of the United Nations Secretary General. When the Sun City talks collapsed, he spent time negotiating both inside and outside the Congo, together with the help of the South African government. He successfully obtained the global all-inclusive agreement. The agreement ordered a cessation of hostilities and committed the country to a long political transitional process path that should lead to legislative and presidential elections within a period of 2 years, starting from the time the transition government is put in place. Prime Minister Niass also helped negotiate the agreement for the creation of the National Army. I would like to conclude my remarks by emphasizing the fact that samples of negotiations and reconciliations in Africa are not limited to the process in South Africa, Rwanda, and the Republic of the Congo. The African Union and the regional bodies such as SADC and ECOWAS have also been involved in other conflict areas as mediators or peace underwriters. It is also worth mentioning that every conflict situation is different and may thus require a particular reconciliation approach. Also, conflicts have complicated roots, and there is rarely a single determinant. Ethnicity, religion, economic resource scarcity, for example, may be at play. However, whatever the circumstances, it is noteworthy that one cannot build a reconciliation on a foundation of injustice. Justice is the bedrock of any community or nation that seeks to be free of resentment and wounds of history. Thank you for your attention. I would be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Questions from the audience, and a couple of them are somewhat related, so I'm going to raise them together. What strategies have you found to be most effective in building leadership capacity among young Africans, and what qualities do you see as being critical for leaders in Africa, and basically for any leaders?
I think young Africans or old Africans and young or old whoever, we are all like little children. We like to be recognized. And one of the ways to get people to do the best that they are capable of is to recognize merit, see the good in them, encourage that, and make sure that nobody feels pushed aside for whatever reason. That if he's not getting promoted or doesn't get the limelight, the fault is not in the president, dear Brutus, but in us that we are underlings. So the effective leadership also comes from teamwork. I know the wisdom of the world is never all assembled in one head. You have to recognize you are with other people. And even when you know precisely what to do, give them the chance to opine, to express their views. And even if you take a decision which is different from their views, they will know that you had taken into account their views, but you had, as the final arbiter, come to the conclusion of what to do, because, after all, the backstop with you.
That's right. I think we have someone who knows Botswana. He says, Pula. Sir Ketumile Masire, please describe Botswana's relationship with De Beers. As a company with a near monopoly on the world's diamonds, I fear that De Beers' relationship with Botswana is one of exploitation rather than cooperation that benefits the Botswanan people.
I think this is far from the truth. We recognized when the BS came to Botswana that they were not a charitable organization. They had come there to make money, and we must give them the opportunity to make it. But that they were going to be taking away our resources, and that we also had the right to claim a fair share of that which duly belonged to us. So we negotiated very hard, and we are the envy of people who have also come up with mineral agreements with other companies, that we get a fair share. I won't say how much, but it's considered by everybody to be a very fair share.
I hope you won't mind, sir. Since a few of us have privileged information on the fair share, I should say that our provost, who is a professor of accounting and business, in fact noted that perhaps we should be doing a study of Botswana for other countries on how they can maximize their profits from companies who invest. We move on to a neighbor that is having serious problems, and that is Zimbabwe. And two people in the audience ask about the status of Zimbabwe. It says, please comment on the current situation in Zimbabwe. Some have described Mugabe's policies as a form of genocide, with the destruction of housing and the severe food shortages. Is some form of resolution possible?
Well, the Secretary General of the UN has sent his commissioner to go and investigate the matter, and a report has been produced, and I think we should await what the Secretary General says of that report and what action he feels he decides must be taken, whether to be given to the Security Council or to whoever. But I don't think it's fair that I should come here and pronounce judgment on my neighbor when he is still being looked at by as highly placed a person as the UN Secretary General.
I'm not going to let you off the hook right now. I'd like to pursue this, because as a former head of state, you're no longer looking for the right thing politically to say or do, but you still have many, many contacts all over the world, but especially with your colleagues and heads of state in Africa. And I'm wondering, as a former head of state, if you feel or if you work at all quietly outside of the limelight to, in fact, approach people like Mugabe, or to have quiet conversations to try to persuade them towards the democracy that you upheld so well in Botswana?
Well, as you know, heads of state don't come running to other heads of state to tell them what to do. But quietly, heads of state do come to other heads of state and whisper to say, don't you think this thing could be done better? And it's no secret that the SADC heads of state have one by one and in a group talked to President Mugabe. I'm not going to say what they said to him, know how he replies to them. But certainly, I can assure you that other heads of state do have interaction with him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. I think many people in this audience would like to see more interaction with President Mugabe, as you've heard over the last couple of days, I think.
Perhaps actually this question is late, because I've been invited by President Mugabe to go to Zimbabwe. And if only you had asked me this question after my return, then I might have been in a better place.
Then you'll have to come back. Yeah. Excellent. Well, we hope you will carry with you the message from many people outside Zimbabwe who wish that Zimbabwe could return to its former development and democracy and human rights. So with that, let me ask, do you support increased United Nations military involvement in African conflicts?
Something which is very encouraging has happened. Since the decolonization process in Africa, the African presidents and prime ministers have formed this organization called the Organization of African Unity. And it had the tendency for the presidents to go to whatever place, venue they chose, and exchange pleasantries and do very much, very little that could excite the world. But a couple of years ago, the African leaders met in Durban, and they decided to change the character of the African Union, and therefore renamed it the Organization of African Unity, and renamed it the African Union. The African Union came up with a program of action, both political and economic, and came up with a program called NEPAD, which is a program for political and economic development of Africa, which says, well, perhaps 40 years ago, we could blame colonialism, but 40 years down the line, we must look around and see what is it that we have done ourselves. And if we want to go ahead, shouldn't we take the lead and do so that other people can help us when they see what we are doing? Now, they have shown their muscles. A few things have happened. And they have taken a stem action. When Togo was going to be the old story of just the president, somebody grabbing power and saying, being left like that because it's an internal affair, this time, both the regional organization ECOWAS, as well as the African Union said over our dead bodies, you are not going to have it. And that didn't happen. The person who wanted to take over power just had to accept there must be a general election, the rule of law must apply. The rule of law was that if anything happened to the president, the Speaker of the House should hold a temporary, should have a temporary hold on to the presidency until an election was held. And that indeed did happen. Things were going berserk in Ivory Coast, and the African Union have detailed Thabo Mbeki as their emissary to go there and make sure that things are done properly. Now in Darfur, in Sudan, the African Union has sent a contingent to go and see that things are contained. But we must admit that sometime the spirit is willing, but the pocket is weak. Sometimes the spirit is willing, but the pocket is weak. If you send a contingent there, You must have resources to fly in supplies to them. You must have resources to fly out those who are injured, and so forth and so on. And I think they have lived true to their Durban undertaking, that they must show that they are willing, they are doing as much as they can do, and then the rest of the world should give a helping hand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Since you started this somewhat tour d'horizon of looking a little bit around the continent, mm-hmm. Some of these questions continue that. And we go back to the DRC and also to Darfur and to the issue of borders. So I'm going to try to put this together as one question or several parts of a question, drawing on your questions. Are borders in Africa one of the primary causes of conflict? And what do you think we need to do to try to consolidate democracies in countries that are still in transition?
I think the one good thing, having run down the OAU, I must say the one good thing they did when they met in Addis at their first meeting was that the colonial borders must be respected. Because if the colonial borders were not respected, there would be chaos in Africa. Because the colonial borders have almost every country, they have cut tribes in half. You find in Kenya, one brother is a minister in Tanzania, the other is a minister in Kenya. One minister's brother is a minister in Uganda, and the other brother is a minister in Somaliland, or things like that. So they have they laid down that as a guiding principle, and they have honored that. Sometimes there is a tiff about an island here or an area which promises to have oil there. But that is what now is the case. But there are no serious border disputes.
Ethiopia-Eritrea?
Well, Ethiopia and Eritrea, yes, that one is it's true. They do have a border dispute, and that has been attended to, but there is none as deaf as those who would not like to hear, because a judgment has been pronounced, and that it's not being respected doesn't mean that nothing has been done.
It's true. The test is always an implementation, as you mentioned. It's very difficult to get it implemented.
We actually have the former permanent representative of Botswana has been there for 2 years now as an emissary of the United Nations Secretary General to try to make peace between the Eritreans and the Ethiopians. You know, the Isaias and Meles were talked of as two heavenly twins.
Yes.
We never thought they would fight, but there they are. Even brothers do fight.
Mm. And violently. As I think there's a saying that says when elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled.
True enough.
Yeah. What are the key causes of the conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and does religion play a role both in the conflict and in the peacemaking?
The Congo is a very unfortunate position because it's one of these times when your virtues become your vices. The Congo is the richest country in Africa. Is the biggest in Black Africa. All the rivers of the nine neighboring countries flow into the Congo. They say they could generate power that could set the whole of Africa alight. And because they have these resources, different powers are backing different groups. And therefore, whenever there is a likelihood of understanding among the Congolese, those who think their groups are going to be at a disadvantage stoke the fires. And the Congolese don't agree, therefore. But apart from outside interference, there is also the misfortune that Congo was never a colony in a conventional sense. The Congo was a private property of the King of Belgium. He ran it like somebody runs a farm of his own. And when the king relinquished his hold on the Congo, it was taken by the Belgian merchants, who really didn't run the country for the benefit of a good administration which would benefit everybody. It was just what interest the rubber tycoons wanted, or those who were mining copper wanted, and developments and administration were restricted to those very narrow confines. And therefore, one had hoped that when the Congo became independent, that this situation would be changed. But unfortunately, there was just a black Leopold X in the person of President Mobutu, who just ran the country as if it was his a private farm. And unfortunately, again, there was the Cold War, where you didn't need to do anything right. You only needed to be either under the armpit of America or to be under the armpit of Russia. And once you had fulfilled that, it didn't matter what wrong you did. You would have to get what you want because you are going to be kept in the fold. That, unfortunately, was then the misfortune of the Congo. So we negotiated the negotiations that took place, the inter-Congolese dialogue. What worries one was that there was no cohesion, there was no common purpose, there was no interest of the country. Men go to war to defend the right of the country. They put their lives at stake. But in the Congo, the country must be put at stake for the benefit of the individuals. That, unfortunately, is a position. And until that changes, the Congo will remain in a turmoil.
If I might follow up on that, since you succeeded so well in unifying Botswana and in really making the national identity the salient identity and not the ethnic or regional identities, I wonder if you would have any recommendation for Joseph Kabila, the current president.
Perhaps if the Congo has been able to run itself for two years and has had a temporary government, perhaps it's because we had them in Botswana, and when they left Botswana, the battle cry was the spirit of Gaborone. And we are very much encouraged that they were going to do what they saw in Gaborone and live up to it. But unfortunately, they did not. But if I have failed, it's not for lack of trying. I certainly have tried.
Speaking of trying and actually succeeding so much, one of the questions is, so that we can teach and emulate, what in your background contributed to the development of your empathy and objectivity?
I think we're very fortunate in Botswana in that we started very poor. And we therefore became very frugal in the use of our resources, both human and material. And I think that has influenced us a lot. And therefore, you'll realize I'm not in a position to advise those who are already having money oozing out of their ears.
You know, I must say, I don't know why, but what you've just said reminded me so much of Joan Kroc, who started out really with very little and who was so wise with what she did because she didn't start with it.
Very good.
I think so. Looking back on your accomplishments, is there anything that you would change?
I would not be human if there were none that I would change. Yes, there are a few things that I would change. For instance, before we implement a project in Botswana, we have to have an environmental impact study done. And so we engaged, we wanted to use surplus water from the Okavango to dam it, so that we control the flow instead of just getting dissipated in the wild Kalahari sands. And we are very democratic in our approach. So we approached the Maun people and talked to them into agreeing that we must do this thing which would give us the opportunity to manage a resource. But we don't live in Mau, we live in Gaborone. But the tourist operators live with the people in Mau, and they know their traditions, their fears and hopes, and told them that their grandfathers live in the river, and if it's tampered with, the gods will fall upon them. And the people became very agitated, and we decided, we had already assembled a team there to construct dams to hold water. If there is surplus water, it gets into dam one, and if there is extra, it is released into dam two. But people just rose up in arms and said, over our dead bodies. And as a democratic president, I yielded, and we had to pay the teams that had assembled there a demobilization of 8 million pula. You may not know what pula is, but it's a lot of money. That's where I felt I should have been despotic. I should just have gone ahead because that was the right thing to do. But I did the wrong thing. I listened to them.
We could use more leaders like that. As our last question, if you were teaching middle school, and again, we're here in a university where we have many students interested in learning, and we also have a lot of youth. I think we might have some high school students also in the audience. What would you want to communicate as a former teacher yourself? What would you want to communicate to your students about peace building?
Well, I think the first thing I would say to them is that no man is an island. Even Monroe Doctrine has failed. And therefore, they must realize the more the world develops, the more we truly become citizen of a common village. And therefore, we bear one another's responsibility. There are things that are happening to humanity at large that really ought not to be allowed to happen. I give an example of education. There are countries where only 40% of the children are receiving education, primary education. And primary education is primary. And you can imagine a child born in this day and age. If he grows to be 70 years old, in 70 years' time, especially if you look back 10 years back, and you see how much progress has been made. And the progress that is being made is not in arithmetic progression, but in a geometric progression. And therefore, if you don't send children to school now, you are really shifting them to the animal kingdom from the human kingdom. And therefore, I would say that it is our common responsibility as human beings to make sure that some of these don't happen in whichever country. And I think those who have the means ought to look at things like that. It's not the only thing. But my lesson to the students would be that they have a responsibility, and that humanity is investing in them, and humanity expects the result of that investment from them, whether it be in their country in America or in a faraway country.
Thank you. Thank you. Please join me again in thanking Sir Ketumile Masire.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.